I mean, so I definitely think that that's one of Slavoj Žižek's critiques as well, that it's the capitalist system that is the heart of the problem.
Right. See, he would, yeah, so his solution to that is a sort of, let's take over the government and use the government wisely and hopefully more democratically and try to direct these forces of production in a scientific way. I don't know, I think that's a problem, you know?
Well, so, right, and I was talking about, like, 2010, and, like, at that point in time, I was trying to think about how... So there's something magic that capitalism does where this system of credit, it, like, creates, like, this, you know, out of nowhere. Like, it's the idea of... If a business is stagnant, like, you can just get a loan and then, what is that called? When you, you remodel your whatever so that you can grow. But, you know, it's almost like this, you know, where you have to, it's the whole idea of credit. Where... But you need to do something in order to get the credit, and so the only way to justify the credit is to experience year-over-year growth forever. It's not enough to just...
Yeah, and then there's interest on the credit as well that you have to pay back, right?
Right.
That's the whole banking scam, right, in a nutshell, right? And then this is what gets... picked up by people like Ezra Pound in his critique of capitalism. And because he wasn't accommodated by the left at all, he turns to fascism, which is, at that time was just a new thing, right? And so it seemed like at that time in the 1920s and 30s that here's a system that is going to deal with the banking scam, you know? But then, of course, the problem there is that then it becomes a scapegoat against the Jews, right? Who are the bankers, like the absolute archetype of the bankers, right? And so it's the Jews that are the problem, and not the actual banking system, right? But the basis of it, it's credit. It's the way that, like you said, it's the way that we deal with credit, that we get credit for certain things, for certain enterprises, and usually those enterprises, they have to be backed up or rubber stamped by the state, right? Given the okay by the state, which is the ruling class, and then you're able to do these certain enterprises, but only if you end up paying back the banks with interest, right? And so the banks are always expanding on whatever enterprises they credit.
Did you see The Big Short?
No.
Yeah, that's a fun movie. It was about the 2008 thing where, I mean, so you think about the banking as like something more than what it really is, and it's just a swindle, like what you're saying, you know, straight up. And so that's what was happening, is that the banks wanted to make money, and so they're saying, well, let's put a whole bunch of these shitty things into a bag, and then we'll have other people buy the shitty things, because it must be safe if we have enough shitty things in a bag. They can't all... You know, like, it's... like.
And hopefully nobody looks into the bag.
Right, exactly. well, that same guy who wrote The Big Short wrote a book called Flash Boys, and so there were these traders, and the whole thing was their computers were the fastest, or so they figured out a way to game the system basically and know what other people are doing before they did it, because they had faster like they had more bandwidth.
Oh, and they set up their operations closer to the market or whatever, like
right.
physically closer, so that they can get the like 1/100 of a second quicker information than any of their rivals, right?
So somehow they're able to know what the market's about to do, and then they can do it, and it just. I don't know. It seems like everything, the whole world, our whole economic society is built on this kind of sham. At the heart of it.
Yeah. See, that's why Ezra Pound is so profound in that way, because he's taking his analysis to a kind of metaphysical level and saying that what this force is doing, which he calls usura or usury, basically. But he kind of, like, it's almost personified as this kind of malign, like, spirit almost, right? But it's basically funneling out or rechanneling the productive power of life in general, humanity and life in general, and kind of squeezing it at its source and projecting it elsewhere, right? Where life, in general, naturally, it's like the sun. Like the sun just provides light and warmth equally everywhere. And that kind of power of life coming from the sun should go down to the earth and be rechanneled in the same way on earth, right? So Pound had this idea of the Confucian Chinese model, right, where... you read in the Confucian texts, and all the good emperor had to do, like the Emperor of China, all he had to do was stand facing south. And then the whole of his empire would align behind him. You know, like all, if he stood south in the proper way, then all his ministers would act in the proper way, and then all their subordinates would act in the proper way, and all the way down to the people. And everything would be in order, and all of the productive capacity, the empire would be distributed equally and sufficiently to everybody. But that gets interrupted. That process gets interrupted by usura, right? Where at some point this other force taps into these energies and rechannels them, kind of diverts and perverts them into different directions. And then all kinds of things happen, like artists are unable to be creative because they're so busy at trying to just feed their families and themselves. You know, things don't get built, discoveries don't get made, because all of this stuff is wasted, right? All this energy is being rechanneled into the pockets of a few. Who are not letting it trickle down to the rest of society. Mm. So I like that idea, you know. The problem is trying to like extricate that idea from any sort of fascism. But I think it can be done, because Pound's sources are not only fascist. He takes his ideas from all over the place, like from this, I can't remember the guy's name, but he was an anarchist economist that was briefly in the government, the revolutionary government of Bavaria in like 1918 or something, and he developed this kind of one of the first cryptocurrencies that's based on demurrage, where the value of the currency gets less and less the longer you hold it, you know. Like, so if you try to hoard money, you're losing money all the time. So you have to keep it in circulation. So it prevents hoarding, and then it prevents accumulation of wealth.
Yeah, there was something that I heard Slavoj say in one of those podcasts that I listened to. I thought it was really funny. He said that he would talk to the fascists, but he was unwilling to talk to the New Agers. And I think he was talking about like Jungians actually, but
He hates it.
The fascists, I think, like it's this wave of people who espouse the Jordan Peterson stuff.
Oh yeah. Yeah. He calls him fascist. I can see that.
But as you were talking, like you were talking about cryptocurrency, and it's interesting because Bitcoin really didn't behave the way, or maybe it did. I don't know. But maybe it was in a Douglas Rushkoff, but he was talking about like flow currencies that behave in a way that don't lend themselves to hoarding, like what you're saying. Which is really fascinating to me. I need to reread that book. But he wrote a book called "Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus," and it was all about different modes of economics that work for everyone and not just the people with the wealth. Because it does seem like, and this is the thing about our system that it's always driven me nuts, is that once you do have wealth, it grows. So we were talking about Barry Lyndon, where he was having a hard time maintaining that fortune, but it seems like once you reach a certain point with a little skill, your fortune should just duplicate.
Yeah, it looks after itself. You just hire people to manage it for you, and then they know all the tricks of the trade, and they can increase your wealth, double your money at any point.
Even the whole housing system, where like renting is a sucker's game, and that like because that was the whole 2008 thing. The value of houses are always increasing. That it just seems like, you know, you can't go wrong if you have real estate,
right?
Although it's really fascinating because it seemed like over Christmas weekend there was this moment where it seemed like maybe everyone was going to lose their retirement, like the stock market was going to completely collapse, and that's when the system actually really does fail.
Yeah, that's bound to happen, you know, because all the lessons of 2008 were not learned. it was just the governments absorbed the debts, the bad debts of the banks, right? And then and so instead of the banks popping out one by one, you have governments popping out one by one, like Greece and then Italy to some extent, and other places in Europe and different states in the U.S., you know. Once you've brought everything down to zero, you brought the interest rates down to zero, you can't do anything else except put them up again. And once you do that, you expand debt, you know. So what they're left in a situation now where all the tricks that they could pull in 2008, they don't have those tricks anymore. I don't know, it's bound to happen. Like people are saying maybe next year, you know, where it starts to really crack again.
The thing that I think about is that anything they do to take advantage of younger people. So like when I first hit, you know, college campuses and they had people handing out credit cards.
Yeah.
And they really were, I mean, it's nothing, you know, like here's a credit card with $1,000 limit. Right. But it's so much fun to go to a record store and buy, you know, like $100 worth of CDs back in the 90s. It's like, wow, look at this, all these CDs. Everything was so different back then, where you needed the physical item to get the commodity that you wanted. It wasn't just on the internet.
Yeah.
Like, even with Apple Music, where, I don't know, I think our whole mentality has changed to everything, where you had to do your homework and you needed to know what you wanted to take a chance with, because you were going to spend, you know, $10 to $12 on it. But yeah, so anyway, you know, at the same time, they're giving student loans to people. And then you go and you buy a TV every semester or something stupid, right? And then all of a sudden, at the end of your college, if you hopefully have a degree, then you're 60 grand in debt or, you know, or yeah. more.
Yeah. It's peonage, basically. It's like another, it's the feudal system again, almost.
Right. But there's a lot of debt out there. And this what Bernie Sanders was saying of like forgiving all those student loan debts just seemed magic to me.
Oh, yeah. Well, I talked like years ago, I talked to a friend of mine who went to McGill University law school there, which is one of the biggest law schools in Canada, at least, but I think around the world. But she was saying that...
Is that the school that you went to that one of the authors that we read went to as well?
At McGill, yeah. Who were we talking went to McGill? Which author was that?
I don't remember. It was...
That was in Infinite Jest. Like, the character went to McGill. The mother.
Avril.
Yeah.
She went to McGill. Okay.
Right. But this woman was saying that even law students who go into law school and they go in really idealistic and really with the mind to use the law to help to benefit people in like lower classes or people really facing difficulty because of the inequalities in the system, right? They really go in with that in mind. That's forefront on their brain, and then they go through the law school, and they come out of it and they're in debt, like highly in debt, because it's even more expensive than other degrees, and they're like, "Oh, I can't do this community law right away because I have to pay off my debts, but meanwhile I've got this offer from this corporate firm." So maybe I'll just go in with a corporate firm for a few years, try to pay off my debts, and then I'll go into what I really wanted to do. But inevitably, they just get sucked into the system from that point on. You know, they as they're trying to pay off their debt, they get further and further advanced in their career at this corporation, and then it's harder and harder to get out of it, right? And so even at that level, which is the level of the law, the level of creating laws and trying to defend people from the law, it gets twisted right away, you know? So then there are less and less lawyers out there who are willing to fight for just poor people and other people who are kind of laid low because of the system.
Yeah, it seems like... There's a movie called Salt Lake City Punk, and that was the thought, that this guy's going to change the system from inside.
Yeah.
But I don't know that it ever happens, but that's still the same premise I think that Philip K. Dick operates from, that, you know, with his whole The Plasmate or whatever, Black Iron Prison, that it is this divine invasion, that you insert this antibody into the diseased host, and that it heals the thing from inside. But we're talking about a messiah at that point.
Yeah, or I don't know if it's a messiah based on an individual or what Yeats talks about, which is he talks about the multiform antithetical influx, right? Which is so it's no longer Christ, which is based on one person. One messiah, a one man that brings matter and spirit together. It's this multiform thing, like this kind of, because it's antithetical, it's no longer based on this idea of oneness, but it's based on the idea of the many, on the multitude. And so in that sense, the Messiah comes from all different angles at once. You know, the second coming really is the second coming of this multitude of influences or singularities, which I thought what I think the kind of genius of Sync is, right? Is that I thought people realized that, you know? It doesn't turn out to be the case.
I've been grappling with this a little bit for a while. I've been speaking with Alan recently about the reception of his film, and he said something really fascinating about how what we know as Sync is actually like an art response to 9/11. Like, this is the artistic response to that event. And so it's like, you know, maybe. Like, or maybe he's speaking more of like the synchromysticism, this kind of mediated practice of, it's both political and spiritual, like a response to reality,
right? Yeah, definitely artistic.
But I'm also thinking, like, that's one of my own through line. The stuff that I read is just so bizarre that my interests, because I'm interested in science. Like, there's this scientific underpinnings that I just have to fall into every now and again. And, you know, I'm talking about like information theory and chaos theory and anything that informs a little bit kind of this realm that we're talking about right now. Because there really is something strange about with the tool of the internet, our ability to see how we do similar things at the same time, or that we're interested, you know, like there is this strangeness to this idea of zeitgeist.
Right.
And there's not a satisfactory material explanation for me for that scientifically with the scientific paradigm.
Well, that's the thing, like we're saying before, is that we can't reject science, obviously. That's always my temptation in a way, you know. But we can't, you know. It's
not the dogma of science, but the tool of science. Like,
yeah. Even the scientific method or reason itself, you know. It's like going back to Dante. It's like Virgil, who represented reason for Dante, could only he guided him through the infernal and then up to purgatory, but only to a certain extent, and then to the top of purgatory, which is the earthly paradise, he was no longer his guide. That was as far as reason could go. But you can't even get to that point without reason first. You know, it's necessary to really go into the science and contemporary science, like science that is new right now, and get a grasp of it before we can go anywhere beyond it. And if we don't, it does become the new age kind of thing, you know, where it's just whatever, you know, like, I think that's what Bruno was on about too. Like, that's why Bruno is really interesting, because you get all these scientists like, what's that guy's name? Tyson. What's his full name?
Neil
deGrasse Tyson. Yeah, Neil deGrasse Tyson. Yeah, his hero is Bruno, right? But it's clear that he's not looking into the whole mystical side of, or the occult or hermetic side of Bruno at all. You know, he sees Bruno as a kind of martyr of science and free thinking, which he is. You know, but without that side of it, without the hermetic side, the occult side, we don't get the real Bruno, you know. And so he's also a hero. Bruno becomes also a hero to the theosophists and the sort of neo-hermeticists and occult people as well, right? But ultimately, those two have to come together, you know? So Bruno, I think he has the key. He's the one that we should be looking for, because he already had the idea of the infinite worlds, right? And that Earth is just one of an infinity of worlds across the universe. But there's still meaning to be had from it, because we're still at the center. If you do have an infinite universe, every point of it is at the center, and that center is God. So he unites the universe with God at every single point of it. But what happens with modern science is that whole kind of, they take his idea of the infinite universe, but then they cut out God completely. You know, it's not sacred at all. You know, it's completely desacralized. So what has to happen is that sense of the infinity at every point. You know, the divine at every point. So we don't need to revert back to the kind of crystalline spheres of the planets, but we could still live in this kind of infinite universe, but still have complete meaning within it. I really think that someone like Joyce, that's what he's trying to do, you know, especially in Finnegan's Wake.
It'll be interesting, because so along this journey, I'm just personally, and I've been doing this for so many years, where things attract and themes, and it's just silliness oftentimes, you know, what I take as the pointer, you know, to what's next.
Right.
What story do I need to find the next clue, or whatever it is I'm curious about. But the Borges is definitely really hitting the spot.
Oh, great. I haven't started in on that yet. I've heard it before, but it's not really fresh.
Well, so like what you were talking about with the every point reflecting, I mean, it just reminds me of like the Zahir, which was like this... Have you read that story? It's there's like this coin.
I have at one point. I can't remember it.
But it's the same as the Aleph, where the Aleph, where this guy finds an olive in his cellar.
Do you remember that one?
Yeah, and so there's something about like the mystical that's really informing kind of the worldview. That it just feels like our moment is so nihilistic.
Yeah.
Like there's just nothing to hang your hat on. Trump really typifies this, where everything is always shifting and there's nothing you can believe in. That you just...
Yeah.
Like, so he's always saying fake news, which, you know, depending on your political views or point of view or whatever, like all of a sudden... All the bedrock that you can, I believe in journalism. You know, it's like there's no truth. Everything is false. But like,
see, that's what I thought was so radical, and I do think is so radical about Sync, is that it's all about putting the narrative back in your own hands. You know, like seeing the magic in your own life, in your own experience, and then realizing that. That is the headline news, you know. anything else is like is an abstraction compared to that. Like looking up and seeing the same advertisement, the words on an advertisement exactly reflect your thoughts at that same moment. You know, that points into something divine. You know, it points into something. It points to the fact that. Our mind is reflected in the universe, and the universe is reflected in our minds, you know, as a first step to that. That's what synchronicity is. It's just a first step to that. It's the first eye opening of that, you know. But it has the potential of getting deeper and deeper and deeper, right? Especially when more and more people are sort of attuned to that, right? But I think that's what happened with the rise of Trump, is that whole movement, it gets now reshifted back to the parapolitical, right? Where it's no longer about our own experiences anymore, our own subjective experiences, but it's looking into the elite and who's diddling who and all kinds of things, you know? It's like it puts it away from ourselves again, away from our own imaginations, where that, if there is going to be a radical break, that's where it has to happen, you know?
Well, so it's interesting as you say that, it's like, so why is it that when you do receive that divine revelation, that like one of the paths you can go down is trying to codify it and turn it into a religion?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And like oftentimes the act of that kills the thing. That revelation is like dead.
Right, right.
Because you're trying to transmute that revelation to other people. But then the interesting thing, you know, about, you know, this conversation I was having with Alan is, you know, thinking about our own culpability in this moment for, you know, like, what part did we play? Because there, the soup that we kind of came out of, the post 9/11 thing, leads to, you know, like the summer of hate, leads to the alt-righters, leads to Trump, like in some right. strange way. These chaos magicians kind of came out of the same space that we came out of, looking at the same things. It's just,
yeah, I'm almost convinced they got it through the synchromistic stuff, you know. Because it was like Alan and Bill and who else? Oh, you. Yeah, we're on Red Ice, right?
Yeah.
At one point.
Yeah.
that's like the... that might have been where people picked up on these ideas, you know?
But...
Like, obviously, they're in the zeitgeist, you know, so it's hard to say where it comes from, right? But...
Yeah, I mean, I just don't even... I mean, that's more of that, the secret, you know, the power of will.
Yeah. Of course, I want to make it clear, I'm not blaming you guys. Like, how could I? You know? Like, at that point, nobody knew where Red Ice was going to go.
Hmm. I don't, but the same thing, like, in the first, in Sync Book Volume 1, you know, one of the authors wrote,
oh, what's his?
Kyle Hunt.
Kyle Hunt, yeah.
Yeah. And I've forgotten what he's become infamous for, but, like, I think Alan's criticism of that is, like, he has, like, he turned the prism around, where he took all the colors of the rainbow. You know, it's like the Pink Floyd album cover. So his piece in the Sync Book was called The Rainbow Alphabet. But he's taking all the prism and turned it around so you get to the pure white light on the other side.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, that's a good metaphor for it.
Yeah. But I think, so he what was his thing? It was the... White Man March, or I don't know. It's just. I mean, that's the shocking thing, that this stuff is. I mean, so it's shocking that Joe's video received 4.5 million views. Like, that's like to become part of pop consciousness, to be out there as like a thing. That's mind blowing. Like, of course, like the ideology underneath it. Of course, it's just the pop culture that actually goes everywhere. But then, you know, the underside of that, like we were saying, so Lana from Red Ice is on the cover of Harper's Magazine, or Kyle Hunt's White Man March, or whatever it was. You know, it's like out there in the mainstream press, and people are like, that informs that ideology, like the practice.
I remember one thing that Kyle Hunt wrote. I think Alan directed me towards it. And he was writing about synchronicity again, and how that synchronicity has always been a part of this kind of extreme right-wing viewpoint. Definitely culminating in Jung himself, you know, who was a figure on the right. As a lot of these guys are, you know, including Campbell, you know, to some extent, you know. So that's one thing we have to deal with as well. I've talked to Jason about this a bit too, is that that's one thing that we didn't really deal with, the sync community or whatever we want to call it, is the politics of the people that inspired us, right? Including Jung and these guys, right? And how these studies into synchronicity and so on align themselves naturally with kind of a right-wing ideology. And it's really hard to kind of get away from that, you know? It really takes effort to get away from that, but a lot of people involved are apolitical, like understandably so. Nobody wants to be political, you know, and people are artists, you know, they just want to do their art. But without being politically conscious of that, it's almost we're led down the garden path. It's already set out for us.
There's something that I've, so like Ayn Rand, these obsessive types that are able to think to create the worlds, you're like to, or think the super deep thoughts. I've realized that maybe they're not the right people to be getting life advice from. And this thought came back to me when I was just doing my rudimentary look at like Borges's bio. Like, I think he was a virgin until into his 30s, maybe his 40s.
Oh, wow.
I think he was married at 68. Like, he had a really strange relationship with his mother. Like, his writings are fascinating and they contain multitudes, but I don't know. You know, I wonder about these messiah types. Again, it comes down to people who are creating philosophies, but they're not necessarily like prescriptions for how to live. They're like on this journey of self, but it ends up when they say things, they say it with so much authority, you think that, you know, they are the light and the way.
Yeah, exactly. Like we were talking the last conversation about Yeats, W.B. Yeats talking about the choice of either perfecting the work, the art, or perfecting the self. And he chose the first. Like he chose to, let's perfect my art, you know? But what that means is that the self kind of falls apart, you know? So it's, the path of the artist or the path of the sage, you know? Or the saint, the path of the saint. And these guys aren't saints, you know, like none of them are. Joyce's life is completely messed up. Like he had terrible relationships with all kinds of people and is a terrible father, you know. What do we do in this case, right? But on the other hand, it's the work that inspires people, you know. There are millions of good fathers and mothers out there, but they don't get any recognition at all, you know? Aside from in their immediate family, I guess, but then you have these fucked up artists who produce something incredible, and it changes the culture of the world.
Yeah. Right. I think maybe David even mentioned like someone like a Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
But like how much suffering went in to make a Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know.
So yeah, it's kind of, I don't know. I think eventually though it will pick up again where we left off, you know.
Well, I always look back and think about how much better my art was, or how, boy, I really should have appreciated, you know, the work that I did, you know. So even I look back at old emails, you know, where like I have hyperlinks and I have like, you know, this is a little sync post in itself. I have a little email here and, I link to three other referential things that link to itself. There's something I really find interesting about, and this is, it's the same as language, is that language is not, it's not concrete, that other things define other things, that you need this net-like structure to support anything.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no word makes sense in isolation.
And that's a quantum universe.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. You need other words to create relationships, to create a structure so that you can have... Yeah, and you don't have a story unless you have, like, interaction. You need characters doing things. Mm. I don't know what I was saying.
Oh.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, I might have derailed you there.
No, I always derail myself. Oh, we were talking about like the nature of sync, and so I worry that this is a diminishing art form, that like our best works are behind us sometimes. That we were so inspired as with the early creative parts of it, as we're, and that it just the newest and latest results become like it's diminishing returns. I saw this, and my son got really excited by this too. It was like a solar phone charger that was being charged by the phone's flashlight itself. It looks in theory like a perpetual motion machine. It's like, no, I don't think it works that way.
That'd be nice.
Right, but I don't know, I just wonder about, no, it'll be interesting to see if,
well, it's always like that though with artistic movements. There's this initial blast of energy on so many different levels, and then it gets dissipated or becomes stale or gets co-opted or gets politicized, all these different things, or people try to take over the movement and direct it in different ways, but then eventually it falls apart. And then it gets taken up again, like by mostly by a new generation of people, right? Who then have the same blast of energy again, you know?
Yeah.
Like there's that the quote by Rimbaud, the French poet. He talks about I can't remember his exact words. Like pushing the pushing the boundaries of vision and lunacy further and further into the horizon, right? And then when one visionary worker drops off, another one will pick it up and then carry it further.
Well, every now and again,
off into the sunset.
Like with the texture of time, I wonder if we're not picking up our own thread. Like the things, like, so I think in one of the Borges stories, maybe it's probably the Garden of Forking Paths, where he says the next time I kill you is going to be even more awesome. That's paraphrasing. Ooh. I don't know why. That story is so great, the Garden of Forking Paths, the story that kind of sent us on this journey from the Ada. But
oh yeah,
there's such a wild conceit going on that you have no idea what's going on until like the end of the story. You know, there's just so much infrastructure built into this tiny little story of World War II and spying and, you know, all kinds of stuff. But there's this illusion of, you know, the story going on forever and ever. Because you continually run in the same... What his theme oftentimes is a labyrinth. He's just got labyrinths in every single story.
Right.
That's another really strange thing that... I read Borges in like 2009, 2010, like I was saying. And then I wrote a work called Winter's Labyrinth, and I don't remember being influenced previously by that, all those mentions of labyrinth. But it had to have subconsciously been hold as a structure worthwhile of investigation, because then I made my own investigation of labyrinths.
Oh, great.
Yeah. So it's just, I mean, if you were to look back, you would say, oh, he totally stole this idea. It's like, well, I don't have any memory of even making that connection until now, looking back.
Yeah, that often happens. Eh?
Yeah.
I was just watching Inception again. And that's all based on the labyrinth too. Like one of the characters is called Ariadne.
Yeah.
Doesn't get it. But and she creates these layers. They construct layers of dreams. And as a labyrinth, right? Like a labyrinthine in form.
That's the interesting thing about how that word has been used and misused. It's the same kind of like us saying with theory. But like a labyrinth isn't supposed to be like a maze that you lose yourself in.
Like, yeah, it's something that takes you to the center, right?
Right. A traditional labyrinth is just a circular path that takes you to the center and then back. And so it's almost like this meditation on life where you kind of, you go in and then you go out. Like it's an inhalation and exhalation. But at the same time, it is, you know, life can be, so like it's the same thing used in Dark City where it's this circular structure that you're almost stuck in that you can't get out of. And so I suppose in that sense it could be like, but labyrinthine, that verb, the, like you were saying, you know, the way we think of it is definitely more
maze like
where you're trapped in the maze. And Jason, is it the Minotaur at the center?
Right So the Minotaur is in that movie, in Inception, is his ex-wife, Mal.
Which is bad.
Bad. But, no, definitely, I think it has that sense in that movie of what you're saying, like the proper sense of the word, labyrinth. It's something that does take you to the center and then moves you back, yeah. But the center is also going down further and further into the unconscious, right? And so it's also represented in that movie by an elevator, right? Going deeper and deeper and deeper down. And so at the basement floor is when his wife commits suicide in that movie. It's the same kind of idea, like going down and going to the center. But that movie is really interesting because of its contrast with The Matrix, right?
That's funny. So
The Matrix,
right?
The Matrix only has two levels to it, right? And the first level is the constructed Matrix, right? It's basically authoritarian. It's created by the machine controllers, and then you have the real world, and so it's basically this two level model, although it gets stranger in the third movie. But with Inception, you have this multiple layers, like up to six or seven layers of reality, through dreams, dream within dreams within dreams, and a limbo state, and all the, like, and then you're never really sure if you're in reality or not. None of these layers are created by this centralized, all-powerful force, right? So I feel like, in a way, the sort of alternative culture is still stuck in the kind of Matrix mindset without moving to this kind of Inception mindset, right? Which takes us... like a politics based on Inception, as opposed to, like, I'm talking kind of an esoteric politics based on Inception, as opposed to an esoteric politics based on The Matrix, completely different, you know. To think that there are multiple layers of reality at every point, none of them entirely controlled by any one single force. So this, again, this sense of kind of multiplicity instead of the absolute or oneness, you know. Because the alternative culture is still based on this idea of God in a sense, right? Or the idea, like, trying to replace God with the conspiracy, right? Whatever we want to call it. And so even though it's a negative image of God, it's still comforting in a way, because there is some centralized force there that's controlling everything, right? As opposed to there being nothing. It's just multi-layered infinite weirdness in every direction.
place I ended up really early when I took that conspiracy ride was that, okay, so if it's not a dark elite that is in control of everything. So, and that was the problem I had, is that this is an organization that has absolute power, but is seeking power. Like, they're trying to control us to get more power, even though they have absolute power.
Yeah,
it's
like,
well, I don't understand. And their pace, exactly. The pace of their strategy is glacial, where, like, you read... They went. If you start back at biblical times, you'll see this is where they're formalizing their structures, and this is generational. It's like, this is crazy. This it's a great story, but this is nuts. And so, if it's not that, then it's like it's us unconsciously doing it to ourselves. Like, we're the God.
We're the eye in the pyramid. Right?
We're the eye in the pyramid. And we are, it's like a, you know, I don't even know what you call that, where we self, you know, you did it to yourself, that's what really hurts. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, that's, I thought that's the level where everybody was at, you know? That we've all kind of realized now that we are the eye in the pyramid, you know, and you can even trace that. Like, that's what happened to me too. I was sort of tracing it forward. So you've got the You've got governments, and then you've got the intelligence organizations beyond the governments, and then you've got secret societies beyond them, and then you've got the gods of the secret societies, and then beyond that, you could get into Tibetan Buddhism, where you realize that the gods and the demons of this world are projections of your own self, right? And so then it flips; it goes back onto you, So I thought that's where we're all at, you know, like haven't we already, so why are we now going back to thinking about the CIA, you know? it just seems reactionary to me, you know? Maybe we needed to, like maybe we haven't, we didn't get far enough into the shadow, you know, to really see how dark it is, and to see how dark we are. So maybe that's the reason for it.
As you were talking about Charlie, that's the reaction right there. as you were talking about Inception and the unconscious, I was thinking about Joseph Campbell's hero's journey to, you know, and part of that's to the underworld, you know, and
yeah.
The hero brings back the thing that founds the new society, whatever it is.
Yeah.
What is it in the safe that they get in Inception? Oh, it's his father. It's like the pinwheel, isn't it?
Say it again. What's the question?
In Inception, you know, like the whole trip of the movie is to try and get open the safe in the movie. So is it a pinwheel that's in there? It's his father's love or something that really is what the character is after.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. He starts. He realizes that his father actually loved him all along, and his father wanted him to not follow in his footsteps, meaning just continuing on the empire as it exists, but to destroy the empire and create his own. Or destroy the big corporation and create his own. And that's the Inception. But this is, I watched the movie again. Like I actually watched it with a class of mine, right? And then I realized how evil the movie is, actually. Like, because they tell you what Inception is all about, and that's only the surface level Inception, right? But the deeper Inception, which was the first Inception, which the Leonardo DiCaprio character used, like that's why he's so convinced that Inception can work, because he's tried it before. And then you find out at the end of the movie he tried it on his own wife, because they got stuck in limbo together. They built a world together in limbo, and he breaks into her safe, like the deepest part of her unconscious, and then spins this top token of hers. And so then when she checks it again, she sees it spinning, and he's already planted the idea into her mind that this world is not real, and the only way to get out of this world is to kill ourselves. And so she goes in the safe, sees the top spinning, and becomes convinced, yes, this is a fake world. And then they agree to kill themselves together. And then they wake up in this world, the real world, but she still has that idea planted in her mind that this world is not real, and the only way to get out of it is to kill myself or ourselves. And then I realized that the whole movie is that. That's what Inception is, you know. The movie Inception itself is an inception to plant that same idea into people's minds, which is it's terrifying in a way, you know. It's like so I was watching it and I was like, fuck, I don't know if I should show this to anybody anymore, you know. So I wonder about Nolan, you know, like I kind of had that idea from his other movies that this guy is not necessarily a good person, but I don't know of other ways to read Inception now.
Thank you.